Try to move it around along, and it will be pretty informal. So, welcome everyone. I see some, of course, I see many familiar faces. I see some new faces. It's a pleasure to have you today, despite the suddenly nice weather that has descended upon us. And this is our opening event in our regular Thursday lecture series. So, I see that the calendars are being passed around. And we thought we would follow what's become sort of a tradition in recent years with Krika, and that is just to begin our lecture series with featuring our local faculty, of whom we have quite a number. And so we kind of take turns each year with having different faculty come and talk about their work to sort of give the Krika community a sense of what our faculty in the various departments are doing. And we also thought that since this is the 25th anniversary of a very important event in our region of the world, that is the August 1991 coup, in which a group of communist hardliners seized Soviet President or Premier Mikhail Gorbachev and held him and sought to take over the government. Ah, the food is here now. So I thought, in addition to, so we have two purposes really today. One is to ask my colleagues to just talk a little bit about their current research, what they're doing. We have three Russianists on the panel today, but also I've asked them to reflect a little bit about how their thinking has evolved in the 25 years that have elapsed since the failed August 1991 coup. So I'm going to ask them to start by just briefly discussing, you know, what they're working on now, what they've been working on in recent years, and then after we have a round of sort of how their research stands now, I'm going to ask them to reflect on how their research has evolved. In particular, I'm curious if they have any thoughts about what it is about Russia today that they find most surprising, or would have found most surprising 25 years ago. It's kind of a challenging way to think about things, but if they have any thoughts on that. So to start off with, let me introduce all three of our panelists. We have Professor Irina Shevchenko from the Department of Slavic Language and Literature, which is now the Department of, someone help me out, Department of many different Germanic, Scandinavian,
German, Nordic, and Slavic.
German, Nordic, and Slavic. Okay, so that's a recent reorganization that has taken place, and that I still haven't gotten used to it, and I don't know if there's the department have either, but we have Scott Gelbach, Professor of Political Science, and David McDonald, Professor of History. So why don't we just move from my left to right and start with you.
Thank you very much for offering me to be on this panel today. I believe now is just a very brief introduction.
Yeah, just a brief introduction.
And then people can start eating.
Right? Sure, yeah.
My research, it's actually, I will start a little bit with the date, with 25 years, because everything I did as a scholar, I did in the last 25 years. So the year 1991, for me, was really the beginning of my career. I applied to grad school a bit. Suddenly, I will reflect later on how I think my vision of late imperial period, this is where most of my research is, changed over the last 25 years. So my most recent research project, and I have been doing different things, but mostly with Russian modernism, with the time period from the late 19th century, early 20th century. The most recent one, which I finalized just this summer, and the book now sits with the publisher and hopefully will come out in the spring, will come out in Russian first. The English translation of the title roughly goes as Modernism as Archaism, with the subtitle Nationalism and the Quest for the Modernist Aesthetic in Russia. And to me, pretty much everything that this project involved in intellectually has to do with my reflections on the end of the Soviet Union and how that end of the Soviet Union changed my perspective on the late imperial period. So this project itself deals with different artistic media. It's was for the first time that I actually really moved from just literature to doing more work on visual arts, on performance. And in general, on a lot of historical contexts, and there was a lot of work, I'm sure that David Mardonov will confirm that, on Russian nationalism done in the past exactly 20 years. And I a lot engaged with this literature produced by historians in my most recent research. And I'll stop here.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. It's
okay. Very interesting. So my engagement with the former Soviet Union both predates and postdates 1991. So my parents chose to take my brother and me along on their 25th wedding anniversary trip, which visited the Soviet Union in 1987.
Oh, wow.
And that was the origin of my interest in the region. But in 1991, I was in business school, finishing an MBA, preparing to go home and run the family business, which was a large farm in central Illinois. It was only several years after that that I decided that I wasn't going to go home and run the family farm and rediscovered my interest in Russia and the region. So my research has moved around a lot since essentially in 1995 I began living and working on the region. So my current research falls into three main areas. So the first of these empirically focuses primarily on Ukraine. So this is a project to examine the economic consequences of political connections. So for example, whether having an owner of a firm who is a member of a clan close to the current president affects that firm's productivity. And so to give you an example of the sort of work that we're doing in that project, this is joint work with John Earle at George Mason University. We have a recent paper in which we show that enterprises in regions that supported Viktor Yushchenko in the 2004 presidential election saw a relative increase in productivity after the Orange Revolution, compared to enterprises in regions that supported Viktor Yanukovych. And so one interpretation of those results, it's consistent with a number of additional results that we have in the paper, is that it's the location in the region that is proxying for the political connections of the enterprises. The firms in Yushchenko regions are more likely to be connected to Yushchenko, and firms in Yanukovych regions are more likely to be connected to Yanukovych. So we're currently in the process of really trying to drill down into individual enterprises and understand what their connections are to particular oligarchic groups in Ukraine by pulling data together from a variety of sources and doing this for a number of years over the past decade and a half. And so that's an extraordinarily labor-intensive process, but at the end of the day, we hope to have something to say about the impact of shocks to political connections like the Orange Revolution in 2004, or like the Euromaidan or Revolution of Dignity, whatever we want to call it, recent political turnover in Ukraine, the impact that that has had on various aspects of enterprise performance. So a second major research area looks at the relationship between reform and rebellion, with an empirical focus on imperial Russia. So this is a new area for me, so working on political economic history, not just contemporary events. And to give you a sense of what we're doing in this paper, let me describe another recent paper. So there's a common perspective in political science and economics that drives many of our theories of political economy, that providing some sort of concession to an excluded group should reduce the probability of rebellion by that group. And it's an intuitive perspective, but it's one that's really at odds with a substantial older literature, really going back to Tocqueville, that suggests that reform intended to better some particular group can often have the paradoxical and counterproductive effect of increasing rather than decreasing rebellion among that group. And so we discovered that we had almost an ideal setting to examine this proposition in the emancipation reform of 1861, so the emancipation of the serfs in 1861. So the emancipation of the serfs directly affected the approximately 21, 22 million peasants in Russia who were serfs, who were peasants living on lands owned by the nobility, but not the equally numerous number of peasants who lived on state lands or who were lived on lands that were owned by members of the royal family. And so we were then able to compare the change in rebellion before versus after the emancipation reform among these two groups by using some really remarkable data that were collected by Soviet historians in the 1950s, 1960s on the peasant movement in 19th century Russia. So these are data, essentially teams of historians over many, many years collecting data on peasants burning the manor house down or refusing to till the land or steal the timber for the local forest or whatever, and documenting in great detail events over decades. And we were able to take advantage of this very labor-intensive process and code up the events for about a decade before and about a decade after emancipation to be able to address this question. And so, in brief, what we discovered is that Tocqueville was right and a lot of conventional political economy was wrong, at least in this case, that reform, the emancipation reform of 1861, had the effect of increasing rebellion among former serfs to a quite substantial extent. And these were really, these were major events. So thousands of serfs protesting, refusing to till the land in some cases, 80 regiments of infantry and cavalry sent out to put down this unrest across Imperial Russia. So that's another ongoing project. Various papers examining the relationship between reform and rebellion in different ways. And my co-author on all of that is Yevgeny Finkel, who is a graduate of our political science program, who's now at George Washington University. And then briefly, a third major project that is less empirically focused on the region, but is certainly motivated by the experience of the post-communist region, uses the tools of game theory to try to model. Game theory is the mathematical analysis of strategic decision making. So use the tools of game theory to try to model the institutions of autocracy or non-democracy. So there's a well-developed literature in political science on the models of democracy, but it's really only the past 5 or 6 years that there's been a sustained effort to try to develop similar theories for non-democracy. So it's a very rich and active research program in both political science and economics, and that's also part of my work.
Okay, well, thanks. That's quite a broad set of topics.
Yeah. Okay, and David.
Okay, I work on the history of the Russian Empire. Traditionally, my interest in Russia or the Soviet Union ended with the advent of 1917, not the actual 1917 in the historical record. But I am, it's a nice thing about the Academy that I get to call myself senior instead of old, but my first contact with the Soviet Union came when I spent a semester, actually a long semester there in the fall and early fall of 1975 and early 1976 on an American sort of residential exchange program to what was then Leningrad. And already there, I was impressed by something that was not gaining a great deal of systematic attention in Western political science, was the gulf that existed between the procedural life and the understanding of formal exercise of power as outlined in the textbooks I'd studied as a political science major at the University of Toronto, and the actual messiness, informality, the types of networks that Scott was describing about with reference to Ukraine, how pervasive these were. Some legal and some sort of clans within the party apparatus, but once you got beyond the thin veneer of state power, all types of quasi-legal and highly illegal networks that made the thing go. And that was a disparity that I sort of took back to University in Toronto and used to switch from political science to history and gradually go from Soviet history to imperial history. And so already by the time I'm in the late stages of graduate school at Columbia in the late 1980s, we're already seeing the advent of the changes that we associate with perestroika. Columbia had the first live satellite link to Soviet television in those years. So we'd gather around the tube in the Harriman Institute and watch Vremya, right? News broadcast, and it was fascinating. And not to derogate Scott's field or not, but we had two groups of historians. Some of us, two groups of scholars, budding or aspiring scholars. Those of us who were historians of the late empire, so late empire I mean probably from 1900 to 1915, 1916, and I'll get back to that periodization in a second. And then our friends in poli-sci, many of whom are still very active and very prominent in the academy and very able scholars, but they were sort of casting around for explanations, and we all who had gone through Duma debates and watched the revolution in 1905 especially and what that had wrought in late autocratic Russia, we were saying, geez, this sounds like a very familiar script. These are very familiar conceptual universe these characters are operating in, their expectations, how they think of power, et cetera, et cetera. So it was this strange fugue state that got all of us, and I'd say it's kept on, thinking about continuities. And I think that's probably one thing that has become ever more prominent in my work and my thinking since 1991 and having watched what went on. But more recently, I've been working. I had two very disparate projects going on until late part of the first decade of the century. One was on the idea of backwardness and how it takes shape in the Russian imaginary, which I anchored it in a combination of processes that pitted a centralizing and, I'll use shorthand, and not a modernizing state that conceived itself after about 1705 in terms that would be familiar to Prussian or Austrian scholars of statecraft at the time. And a countryside populated by the great-great-great-grandparents of the nobles that Scott has been working on in the 19th century, who sort of passively resisted this change. And you get this very interesting transvaluation of status and value in descriptions between the countryside and the metropolis, in which the countryside becomes backwards. And the countryside becomes backward because it resists conforming to a certain notion of historicity, of historical change, historical progress, again to use shorthand, that Petersburgers, as it came to be, or that the Petrine elites and post-Petrine elites had started seeing at work in places like Amsterdam and London, especially the Germanies. And so this whole problem of backwardness and how Russians see themselves as backwards and historicity and absolutism are all tied up. So that was one project that I still got a hand in and hope to return to very quickly. Next one was on responsible government. And the fact that I did a book on how ministers, how senior bureaucrats had seen what was happening with the autocracy in the late night under the reign of Nicholas II. Nicholas breaks an informal deal that had been forged between senior administrators and rulers since the 1840s, and he goes back on it by trying to interpret autocratic ideology in a very literal and assertive fashion. It sort of ruptures this long established understanding and results in the minds of some ministers in the disaster of the Russo-Japanese War and the revolution in 1905 that comes very, very close to putting paid to the whole project, right, to the autocracy. And so I described how they, in the wake of the constitutional reforms that came with 1905, tried in turn to somehow bind the autocrat without binding him. And it exposes a lot of paradoxes in the order as it actually worked as opposed to how they thought it ought to work, and revealed some blind spots in their way of thinking. Responsible government is the idea that any cabinet of ministers in an electoral political system should hold authority only so long as they enjoy the support of the House, right? Those of you who follow British politics, Canadian politics, Australian politics, this is a very crucial concept to the stability of government. And it also represents the nexus between popular sovereignty or claims to it and the state's authority. And people try and enact these things or implement them. There's a very large discussion of it in the late empire, but it never comes off. But those are both being supplanted by some, by a large project that is really, to my mind, that thinking about it as I was walking up in the 80-degree heat through along Bascom Hill, and the humidity started precipitating my thoughts, I've been, for the last several years, I've been involved in this burgeoning project that I helped conceive, and I now serve as one of three general editors for. It's entitled Russia's Great War and Revolution, 1914 to 1921. And this project that would have been conceptually impossible before 1991, maybe even before 1995, and certainly logistically impossible before 1991. It's a group of nine editorial teams, each containing a Russian, Brit, or European, a North American, and a player to be named later, who each have responsibility for a certain thematic rubric: international relations, the military conduct of the Great War, military conduct of the Civil War, what the war and revolution were like in the localities of European Russia, what the war and civil war were like in the Far East, what was going on with popular culture, high culture, and the arts, go on and on, nationality and empire. And so far, we've got seven books out of a slated 25 to appear before 2020. Now, why would it have been impossible? One, and probably most important, logistically, this level of this density of collaboration would have been absolutely impossible with Russian or Soviet scholars before 1991. There were so many. Impediments, shall we say, to that type of active collaboration, just to get over to the Soviet Union, work, be able to get scholars over here and be able to take part in things, let alone the conceptual breadth of the project. So for historians, I think the biggest, the most important contribution of the project is it reconceptualizes a war that dared, a memory that dared not speak its name in the Soviet period, right? The Great War was a suppressed memory in spite of the enormous number of casualties, in spite of the fact that we now know that Russian citizens were subscribing at the same rate as their counterparts in other combatant societies to their equivalent of war bonds well into the autumn of 1916, remembering that the events that lead to the deposition, the abdication of Nicholas Romanov, take place in February 1917, right? Russians were still buying up war loans. And war bonds in great numbers. But also the idea that 1917 no longer represents to us the rupture that it had when I was taking this period in university. We used to just treat it was like those old road race sets that every kid wanted, any male kid wanted in the 1960s. They'd have a chicane, right? You had a jump like this going up a sort of a ramp, and they had these little slots to keep the power bar for the car in. And then there'd be a gap like this, and the car would jump like this and then come down on it, if you did it right. Never worked. But, well, maybe there's an illustrative example there. But we always treated 1917 as this great moment after which everything old was made new, right? And now what we found is, indeed, the war was sort of like the reign of Peter the Great in many ways. It was a very rich and complex continuum or building up and intensification of processes that a lot of things the Bolsheviki use to establish their rule, to put themselves on their feet, to conduct the civil war, is done with personnel that learned their expertise under the imperial order, that were active members of most of the imperial ministries, especially for food requisition, armaments, and military training, and economic administration. A lot of the programs the Bolsheviks claim are theirs are actually programs that are just renamed from their use by the provisional government, the caretaker government that intervened after February 17, and even critical sectors of the imperial government. So this period is not a rupture; it's a bridge, and it helps to explain a lot of the deeper seated continuities and everything from concepts of the state's role, the state's position vis-a-vis the society, the state's role as often a very strict educator, to use very euphemistic language. The other ways in which this project went to be possible before 1991 is anything that took place outside of Moscow or Peter with rare exceptions, say Saratov in the case of a couple of historians, would not have been possible for Western historians before 1991. I can think of Don Raleigh, who got to go to Saratov, Carol Leonard, who got to go up to Vladimir, I think it is, but to get a visa to go to one of these places, let alone to Republican capitals in a place like Kiev, not even to talk about Lviv or any of the Western cities, just would have been inconceivable. You didn't bother asking for it. So in many ways, and ways I'll come back to later, that project, which is, what have we got, 330-odd contributors, a good, between a third and a half of them Russians. I won't even get to the diversity of ideas that, and approaches they represent, from sort of religious idealism to unreconstructed late Soviet Marxism to monarchist nostalgia. I'm not saying this critically, just descriptively. None of this would have been conceivable in 1988 to 91. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. So I'm really struck by some of the overlaps and some of the intersections between the works from scholars in three different disciplines of themes about modernity, about rebellion and social change, about demands on the government. And it's really quite striking how, from the different disciplinary perspectives, my colleagues are working on similar topics. So what I want to do is quickly make a program note, and that is that, some of you know, so the food is arrived. We're feeding one of our speakers because we don't want him to fall over from exhaustion, but I would ask that we bear with us, because I think, what I would like to do is have one more round of the panelists addressing a specific question, and then we'll open up to questions, and then we'll have a big party afterwards. So if you could just hold on to your appetites for maybe 15 more minutes, and then we'll open up to the more festive part of the program. So what I'd like to do now is, our colleagues have already touched on sort of how their work has evolved in the last 25 years, but I want to ask a very specific question, and that is, what is it about Russia today, and it doesn't have to be in your specific area of expertise, but just in general, what is it about Russia today that would have surprised you most to know, going back to the fall of 1991 when the coup had been defeated and it was evident the Soviet Union was collapsing? How have things evolved, or what is surprising, given, I can speak briefly for myself. So I was actually in Russia for the first time myself, and I was in St. Petersburg in 1991, and I actually went back to the United States 3 days before the coup, so I missed all the excitement. I remember just how exciting a time it was even before the coup to be in Russia. It seemed like it was the whole world of possibility was opening up. It was a society that was awakening, that things were changing, and who knew what was going to happen. It was very unpredictable, but there was also a sense of tremendous excitement. At the same time, there was an undercurrent of tremendous fear, anxiety, concern. There was, things were changing. People were struggling economically, but there was nonetheless underlying that, a tremendous, I would say, enthusiasm, an openness, a spirit. And, I would say, to me, what's surprising is I don't sense that as much today. I think things become somewhat grim in Russia, and it's kind of a sad way to think about it. And maybe that's just my own idiosyncratic experience. But I'll just say that sort of a personal anecdote and my quick response to that question. So may I ask the panelists to briefly reflect on how, what is about Russia today that's different than what they would have expected or what they experienced perhaps in the fall of 1991?
Well, I will be answering this question both as a native Russian,
yes, please,
and a scholar.
Please.
And in that, I understand that my position is different. And also as someone who was 24 at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, so I just graduated from the University of Tartu, and as I realized recently, I was in the last year when Estonia was still in the Soviet Union. So that was kind of last graduation from a university located in a territory that became an independent state half a year after that. My personal circumstances were that I returned to Leningrad, well, no, already St. Petersburg, and that happened also in May or June of 91 that the city was renamed. I returned from Tartu there. That's where my family lived. I had no job, and I had absolutely no idea what to do. So that was great openness, and I certainly confirmed that. But for the people who were of my age at that time, it was absolutely unclear what to do, unless you were very adventurous and wanted to start business. And that's what my brother did, but he was 9 years old, so he was more mature by that time. So I almost immediately started, and again, it's kind of strange to say today that in order to apply to a grad school, you first had to write paper requests for application booklets and receive them in the mail, and the mail wouldn't go very fast between the U.S. and Russia at that time. So I was doing that. I was trying to improve my English. So that was my occupation. I was also writing on my couple first articles, trying to use some of the material from my senior thesis, and those were published eventually. So as a scholar, I would say, for everybody in my generation who started off in later 80s with a great interest in early 20th century literature and early 20th century culture, this, that culture that in our imagination was something of this kind of lost legacy, the better part of the lost legacy of pre-revolutionary Russia. There was a certain tradition already established by then in scholarship, and that was tradition from the 60s and 70s, from this generation roughly of my parents, I would say. In terms of scholarship, and that goes to your question, although it's kind of not directly what I would or wouldn't expect. I actually wouldn't expect where my scholarship would go, just at all. In 91, 92, even when I applied successfully and was accepted to Stanford, I more or less thought in that tradition, or within the, thought of myself within that tradition established by scholars of older generation, like Timenchik, like Fleischmann, and so on and so forth. So for whom the most important thing was to reconstruct some factual details and interpret the text. So the most interesting thing would be to sit with the text and to write about it. What various overtones, what this text hides, and how to decipher it. And that was my interest for a while. It was gradually changing, not very noticeable for myself, I would say. Only at some point I realized that I'm now doing something completely different from what I thought I would be doing in my life. And that was a transition, I would say, between what I did for my first book, which was on Tsvetaeva, and still, even there, I would say, between my ideas of the 90s and ideas of the early 2000s when I finished this work. I became much more interested, and I think it's part of what was happening in the course of those 25 years. Made me much more aware of how little I think now both this post-Stalinist generation of scholars in the humanities, how little they understood not just the art, for example, produced by modernists, but the society to which those artists belonged, and the influences that were completely extra aesthetic on them, but which, if you do not understand them, you clearly misinterpret their intentions. As far as what I wouldn't expect, or would expect, or wouldn't expect, to see in Russia today, if I were asked in 1991, let's say, after in December of 1991, Well, frankly, at that time, I wouldn't ask myself what would be here in 25 years. I had no idea I would ever be close to 50, you know, myself. But it would be fair to say that everyone in my generation had that illusion that we were kind of working through and trying to understand what constituted it. The main thing, the main difference between the society in which we were raised and that society which we kind of understood as Western society, that the main difference really is economic system and ideology. Well, in whatever order you put those two things. And both things, it seemed, there wasn't, or at least we imagined, that there exists an algorithm which we can follow, we or people put in power, and that members of educated class in the late Soviet Union could follow, and that algorithm, if you follow it accurately, if you don't make mistakes, or concessions to some circumstances, it would lead you where you want to come. It would lead the society there. Economic reform and this removal of ideological constraints. Because I cannot imagine that anyone in 1991 would name other aspects, other components of what should be changed. Well, exactly this, and exactly it's clear how to. And obviously we saw in the late Soviet Union the problems apparently in our imagination. I'm trying to be fair to what I imagined at the time. certainly the system of government as it exists in the Soviet Union was for us a product of ideology. We could imagine that that system can sort of revive itself, reconstruct itself in total absence of any real ideology. That's probably the most surprising thing, that you can see how the system of government, I'm not a political science specialist, so maybe I'm not using the terms correctly, but that what we see happening in Russia today certainly shows how great degree of vitality of a certain type of government, of a certain mode of government, that no matter what the ideological platform can rebuild itself. It doesn't mean that it was inevitable, and I also don't think that, knowing today what happened, we can also kind of safely go to 91 and say, well, absolutely nothing else could come out of that. Yeah. That's also not true, and there are myriads of circumstances. What if oil wouldn't be so expensive for so long? Like, how that would affect? And also, we also don't know what happens next month after the elections in Russia. I think our generation was, for those of us who were more fortunate to, at some point, not to be direct victims of recent developments in Russia, and a lot of people in both my generation and my acquaintances found themselves in very, very difficult situations. For us, intellectually, it's certainly a very compelling task to come to terms with what we observed. At the same time, I don't think that pessimism really helps. Like you say, nothing good ever can come out of that geographical space, that country. Actually, the best things, the most interesting and encouraging things that I see happening now are happening within the educated class, and they're unrelated to politics as we understand it.
Yeah.
They're related to various different issues. Understanding of the rights of minorities, understanding of, in many ways, in response to how state abuses those things. I will not make any predictions, of course, knowing what happens with most predictions. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for sobering and yet ending on an optimistic note. account. Okay, Scott.
Yeah. So I guess the theme is that disappointment in where Russia has gone is a surprise for many of us who were both raised in the Soviet Union and those of us who became interested in that part of the world. And so as a political scientist, I guess I think about this, or I would answer Ted, I think, in three different ways, sort of ranging from an easy answer to a slightly harder response to a hard response. So I think the easy answer is that 25 years ago, for those who were interested in reforms in this part of the world, the formula for many of those folks, not for all, but for many of those folks, the formula seemed to be pretty clear. So privatization of state-owned enterprises to improve incentives at the firm level and eliminate many of the inefficiencies that characterized communism, stabilization of the macro economy to eliminate the hyperinflation that emerged in the early 1990s, and liberalization of trade both within the country and with other countries. These seem to be fairly obvious reforms and ones that were expected to have large positive effects. People at the time also talked about another set of reforms, which was the creation of formal and sometimes they said informal institutions that provide a foundation for economic growth. So this was the beginning of the turn towards institutions in political science and economics. It was driven substantially by the work of Douglas North, who was enormously influential among many people working on the region. But I would say that fourth area was sort of given short shrift. And it turns out, in retrospect, that it's the creation of those institutions that's really fundamental, that privatization works or it doesn't. And we have, at this point, pretty good evidence that privatization has had a very strong positive impact on firm productivity in parts of the post-communist world, and a not-so-positive, or it takes years for it to take off, sort of impact in other parts of the post-communist world. And the evidence suggests that reforms like that succeed or fail depending upon the presence of a capacity, a state with a capacity to enforce contracts, to provide a supportive judicial and regulatory environment, and the presence of informal norms of economic and political behavior that we, those of us who live in societies like this, more or less take for granted. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's sort of an easy answer to the question, but it was something that took many of us who worked on the region, I think, some time to appreciate. A slightly harder answer to the question is that history matters, that transition was not tabula rasa, that what was going on in 1998 could not be fully explained by looking at the policies or the constitutions that were adopted in 1992. And that's sort of an obvious point for historians, but it was a hard-won lesson for, I think, economics and political science as disciplines. And so what you see in scholarship on the region is that beginning in sort of the late 1990s, the causal apparatus keeps getting pushed back. Or if you want a different metaphor, there's like this metaphor that it's turtles all the way down. It's like we kept working our way down to another turtle. It's like, oh, this turtle standing on this turtle. And, to the point where, at some point, people were looking at the sort of societies that existed before the establishment of communism. So when literacy was established, for example, in different parts of the post-communist world, to try to understand what happened after communism collapsed. And so this parallels a broader, or is part of a broader turn in political science, especially towards history in recent years, where it has become, I don't know, you probably know some of these folks. Like there are a lot of folks in political science who were working on the Soviet Union, had dissertation projects underway, and then the Soviet Union collapses, and their dissertation projects just kind of disappear. And from the perspective of 2016, that's an odd outcome, because these folks had incredible information about the greatest social experiment of the 20th century. Why should we just assume that that's suddenly irrelevant? And I think today that would not be the case. Mm-hmm. But in the 1990s, it was. And so I think there's a greater appreciation for history and a willingness to explore historical topics today in political science, in part because of what happened in this part of the world. And then the hardest answer, and I think this is where my personal thinking has evolved over, say, the past half dozen years or so, is that democracy is not the end or the steady state for most societies. And I don't say that to undermine the courageous efforts of those who push for reform in non-democratic regimes. I believe in democracy as an aspiration. I believe that transitions to more democratic forms of government are sometimes possible. And I believe that even when these efforts fail in their most ambitious goals, they can still often have a positive impact. But the fact remains that today, and likely for the lifetimes of most or all of the people living in this room, democracy, non-democracy, will be the form of government that the majority of the world's population, or some sort of hybrid form of government at least, will be the form of government that most of the world's population lives under. And so that, for me, informs my understanding of what political science as a discipline should be doing, that understanding how politics works in less democratic or non-democratic states, I think, should be a primary goal of political science. I've been in there.
Okay, great. Thank you for a very thoughtful response to the question. So history matters. History matters. Now we can change our history.
Yeah.
Other than I told you so. What else?
It's interesting because I had something else in mind to say, but thinking what Ian and Scott are saying, several scattershot things have always struck me, even going back to the 70s. One is that. And it's something that came up in an informal conversation. We've always had a very distinctive way of thinking about Russia, right? And some of you might have, and there's an interesting paradox that underlies our, saying Western community of scholars, conversations with Russia, with successive generations. This could be Custine, Marquis Custine, going there in the 1830s. It could be Alexander Mackenzie Wallace there in the 1870s and 1880s for the Times. It could be, what's his name, the British, a couple of British scholars made very big, had great contacts in Russia in the late Empire, or the Wabs or whoever going to the Soviet Union. What comes to mind is we tend to sort of, our side puts a narrative of what's normal. So we think of ourselves as absolutely normal. We think this comes up in historiography of the German Empire, by the way, and Germany's, shall we say, eventful 20th century, right? We always, when we're talking about the Industrial Revolution, when Soviet students were reading Die Macht and Capital, that somehow this accidental set of events in a British economy that was first described in a very tendentious way by Adam Smith in the 18th century, this becomes a norm for how everything else is going to work, right? Despite differences in land masses, centuries-old legal regimes, all the rest of it. So that's one, that there seems to be regional tendencies. At the same time, we've got to be careful not to essentialize. And this is what I was thinking of Larry Wolff's work, Inventing Eastern Europe. It's an old work, but it's still worth reading. He's talking about how travelers' accounts in the 18th century and 18th century, well, enlightened ways of thinking about things in Central and Western Europe lead people to start exoticizing and orientalizing not just the Ottoman Empire, but Russia, which moves from being north in people's imagination to being east in a very certain sort of east. But the one thing Larry doesn't talk about but is very striking is several generations of Russian intellectuals, and it becomes part of sort of the discursive DNA, I would say, in Russian ways of talking about nationhood and community and history and self, they internalize these characterizations and respond to them one way or another, and they essentialize them. So one thing that hasn't changed, I don't think, in post-Soviet Russia, but that has really had a new valence is this tendency to essentialize and sort of create these historical categories, at least in official discourse. The second thing that hasn't changed but has changed, and I think it's part of the key to Edina's problems when we're thinking about the 1990s, is, and I think it's Ukraine, I think it's Kazakhstan that some of us know very well, I think it's Uzbekistan that we all of a sudden know better, is these were societies that were constructed on a divorce, and a necessary divorce between a state structure, whether it's the apparat or the chinovnichtva, the officials in the Russian Empire, that there was a gap, and there was a gap in across which the state acted on a society that was always precluded from membership or participation in politics. The state always patrolled the borders of its prerogatives extremely vigilantly and jealously. We even saw that I could get in with the Gorbachev years, but we see this same orientation. There's no expertise among the liberalizers, with very few exceptions, who believe in these mechanical, sort of ahistorical fixes in the 1990s. And so it's a sideways way into one of the things I was going to say in response to Irina, is the 1990s were highly indeterminate. And I never would thought I would have seen them vilified as widely as they are now. The effort to transform those into just the nadir of Russianness and Russian stateness and all the rest of it in these efforts to fashion popular memory nowadays. I think it's having started going there frequently again in the late 80s and early 90s, there was hope. But again, also, these hopes, they don't get anybody fed, right? And it was a time of terrible crisis, instability, national humiliation, I don't think we took sufficient account of that. And one thing that the current incumbents have been very successful at is tapping into and organizing and redefining these memories to make it a time of national disgrace instead of national possibility. And there's nothing inevitable about it, except that most of your administrative and legal expertise had already been part of this older system and oriented itself to that system. And a lot of people who had experienced politics as an area of extreme risk, extreme hazard, jeopardy, disruption, to use a popular term, they very quickly retreated, which also the idea of popular sovereignty, popular participation, things that we take for granted, right? Took 750 years to establish in our societies. There's hardly anything normal about the Magna Carta or the Wars of the Roses or getting out of slavery or Civil War or two world wars. As Nietzsche once said, the categorical imperative is soaked in blood, right? But the three things that really I would never have thought of in the Soviet Union, one's prosaic but had its own possibilities, the possibility of getting good beer. And there was hope in beer. That one of the myths that got shattered in my mind by the Soviet 90s and after is the idea of civil society as a force for domesticating an overweening state power. We always thought these movements would proceed under their own narrative logic. They didn't. There still aren't the real socializing place with strangers in a Russia, and for even the types of political or sports arguments you'd see in a pub in England or a bar in North America, or a cafe in France or Italy, you don't get that possibility in Russia. And even civil society organizations, they are by definition political, right? The state seems to be the only thing that can plausibly represent everybody in society as it claims to do, and in doing so, adheres to a tradition that goes to the late 17th century. So that's the flippant one. The church is the one that we never talk about. And if you want a winner, financially, politically, morally, in terms of presence and influence, the church ranks with any of the oligarchs is almost up there with the seal of Ikea. It's incredible. We're seeing a church that looks pretty much, I would suspect, like it would have under Pobednoy's procuracy in the 1880s and 1890s, and the type of sway it has. And finally, along with the church, and it's a weird, and say if I was going to be a fan instead of an observer, I'd say it's a very perverse confirmation of what Irina was saying about the 1990s, the harnessing of really I'll use British Canadian terminology, arch Tory, like obscurantist religious thought, is now the apotheosis of legitimation of the regime, whether it's Edin, whether it's church thinkers from the late 1890s, or Eurasianism, which itself has become a strange presence in the Russian imaginary. So those are, just, as I say, scattershot reflections.
Okay, well, I really enjoyed this remarkably rich discussion on the part of our panelists. It's just about 5 o'clock, and I don't want to prolong our ceremonies too long, but, can we take just maybe one or two quick questions before one of our panelists has to leave? any comment, question? So how about, go ahead, in the back.
Yes, I think, first of all, it's most informative and analytical panel which you can find in the Middle West, yeah, here about Russia. And I would like a little bit to problematize and have questions to you, to professors. So I kind of know what you're doing. And first to Scott Galberg, yes. Sorry, maybe I'm mistakenly pronouncing your surname. I apologize.
Galberg, thank you.
Yeah. Do you think that the keys now for Ukrainian development, not in the West, but in Russia, and not political alliances determine economy, but economy determining alliances, because Poroshenko, with all his capital, belongs more to Russian oligarchy than to Ukrainian oligarchy, and we can, for instance, ask Manafort how it's going to develop. And secondly, the Professor Gerber, now kind of I inundated these emails from Moscow that University of Medicine closed the Center. Yes. So how do you envision connections between educational institutions of United States and Russia in a situation created by the Putin's regime when everybody, I have a friend who lost her tenure because she were coming to the conferences in Madison and whatever. So now it's kind of a really, really difficult environment. And what kind of advice you would give to Russian scholars?
Okay, before we answer, I want to just take another one or two questions, and then we'll have some quick answers, and we can proceed. So are there other... did you want to ask a question, David?
Well, Gilbach can say, what insight into why it's been so hard to achieve reform in the Ukraine as you've been looking at it at the ground level? Certainly the hopes were high in the Orange Revolution, and they're high now, and they don't seem... all the Ukrainians I know yearn in their souls for something different. So what's the emotional hang-up, if you will? I don't know how to phrase the question even, but as you look at it institutionally, why is it so impossible for this country that wants something better to find it?
Okay. Other...
Oh, I'll have one.
Oh, please.
It's more broader. We have in the Russian intelligence, a part of it thought they could skip capitalism. Both. the Narodnik lived before them.
Mm-hmm. Gerson.
For his Gerson, Chernyshevsky, who built on the bones of the West. We have now, if you want, the Putin regime or the church saying we should skip Western morality. Right?
Mm-hmm.
This is what I say. Now, this was the problem of backwardness.
Mm-hmm.
Should we follow the West or not? Both before and during the Soviet period. Now, to what degree the West is responsible for these things? Are we responsible for some of the Soviet things that happened, the bad ones, I mean? Are we responsible for the, what some say, the failure of democracy, both in the Soviet, former Soviet Union, or in Poland, or in Hungary, what they're calling now, you know, very dangerous developments? Are these questions that we should really seriously consider? Are their propaganda the worst? We have no propaganda? Today's Wall Street Journal said a Russian plane came 30 feet to our Navy plane. The Soviet, the Russians are saying that we invaded their space. Are we historians, political scientists, community people? Here we are. What is our response? How should we interpret those things? Right? We want community involvement. Or should we shut our mouths and say nothing, as we usually do?
Well, okay. So we have some rather... deep and questions, all of which call for very elaborate discussions. I'm afraid we don't really have time to explore in great depth, but would anyone like to offer a quick response on the panel?
Let me address Ukraine in no more than 2 minutes, possibly
two
less,
minutes.
And then I'm probably going to have to take on. So
so
there are two questions on Ukraine, and the first question was, as I understood it, essentially, is the future for Ukraine in Russia rather than the West? And part of the premise of this question was that connections in the Poroshenko government are more with Russian oligarchs, perhaps, than they are with Ukrainian oligarchs. I'm not sure that I agree or disagree with the premise to that question. I'm not sure we know necessarily, but I would say, first of all, that Ukraine is at war with Russia, and as long as that's the case, it's hard to imagine a future for Ukraine being more with Russia than with the West. But the second thing I would say is that it's primarily about internal reform. It's not about external orientation with the West, or on the one hand, or with Russia on the other. And that external orientation can be important. It can be a spur to reform or a hindrance to reform. So I'm not discounting the importance of external orientation, but ultimately what's important is the sort of reform, political and economic reform, that takes place within Ukraine itself. And so this gets to the second question, which is, why is it so hard to achieve reform in Ukraine? And so a first answer to the question is that reforms are hard. So reforms create losers as well as winners. One of the big reforms that Ukraine needs, that it seems to be in the process of carrying out, we will see, is essentially to raise gas prices. And that creates a lot, that's important in terms of reducing opportunities for corruption within Ukraine. That's a major source of corruption in Ukraine. But that obviously creates a lot of losers as well as winners. So this sort of gets to a second point, which is that you have a lot of vested interests, and Ukraine has a system of government that has always sort of operated around the maintenance of certain elites that are close to those in power, and it's unfortunate that that seems to be the model that the Poroshenko government seems to operate by, but is perhaps not so surprising. But then finally, I guess I would say, having been in Kiev just a couple of months ago, there is reform happening, but it's sort of here and not here. It's here and not here. And so what you see is that there are areas where there's been actually fairly deep reform. So Ukraine has an electronic procurement system today that appears to be for state procurement, that appears to be one of the best in the world. And there's a team of folks in the Ministry of the Economy who figured out how to do this and how to, from a technical perspective, but then also from a political perspective, how to push it through. Enormously talented individuals. But then just sort of two doors down in the same hallway, you see folks who are in the ministry as essentially representatives of different oligarchic clans, and they've been placed there to be sure that they're keeping an eye on the interests of their oligarch. And so sort of working side by side within the same ministry, you have folks who are carrying out what seem to be the right sort of policies, and then folks who are there to perpetuate the system. And I don't know, maybe this is the only way to run a system such as exists in Ukraine, is to sort of balance these competing interests, but you certainly have competing interests at the moment. And the only other thing I would say about that is that the Ukrainian budget is not in good shape, and so these folks in government who are there for the right, well, the official salary for sort of everybody is extraordinarily minimal. We're talking a couple hundred dollars a month for those in government. And so for those in government, you essentially have a choice. So you can live off of your savings. And so a lot of the folks who have moved into the government to try to help some of these reform efforts previously came from the private sector, and they do have accumulated earnings, but they're not infinite. And so savings are running out for some of these folks, and so they face a choice. So they can either then become a part of the system, which means receiving an envelope of cash, some sort of informal salary that comes across the table once a month, but then there are certain expectations that come with that, or they give up on the government job and they say, well, it's great that I did that for a year, 18 months or whatever, and go back to the private sector.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Any brief thoughts?
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
With Ukraine, very quickly on Ukraine.
Right, so we'll give a thanks, nice to Scott.
There's more food back there to get on the list.
to go bag,
yeah. Very quickly on Ukraine, if you want, Ukraine's actually a very good illustration of the point I was making earlier about sort of the incommensuracy of skill and capacity and knowledge and networks in what was formerly state, which are all the invisible functionaries underneath the visible holders of power, who, if any of you have seen Yes Minister, this is not merely a phenomenon in post-Soviet systems, it's pretty pervasive in any organized political system. And then a civil society, again, the most active civil society in the post-Soviet space outside of the Baltic, that seemed to live up to every attribute that you would have seen in a civil society in the imagination of a good late 18th century German or French thinker. And it's been absolutely powerless six times. Like, to my mind, the idea of constitution is operationally bankrupt right now in Ukraine, because they've had, what, six constitutions since 1991? And they keep rewriting it with each new regime. But that, very quickly, Phil, to your point, I think you do have a point, and it's something I do say in my public talks, that if we want to understand part of what Russia looks like to us now, and we see a very specific part of Russia, right? We don't see it all, it's just like Soviet times. And we see the part that we sort of learned how to see in the Cold War, where the power center was, we think, very top-down. This whole thing, in many ways, is an after-effect of the Cold War. Our policy response to the 1990s, and with one foot outside the system, was obvious to me then, that we were triumphant. We were triumphant, right? We kept saying to this country, you're no longer a player. Like, even the current incumbent in the White House keeps talking about there's a second-rate power and all the rest of it. And I've never understood the percentage in taking that view, right? All our policies were quasi-colonializing. We cultivated and made clients of using a language that Ted would recognize. We clientelized members of the elite that we liked in Russia without noting, you know, they would talk to us in a certain way and they knew how to talk to us, but they were operationalizing our money and our resources for their own political ends in a system that operated on a very different logic. Not a worse one or a better one, just a different one, right? And that's the other thing, this normativizing thing. We won, so you got to do it our way. And that's a sort of a side road into something. I try not to be a rooter in the press box on these things, but the one thing I have my Goering moment on, I want to reach for my gun, is whenever I hear the West invoked as anything beyond a rhetorical construct, and it's pervasive in, among Russian, not so much intellectuals, but parts of the intelligentsia, and it's certainly pervasive in our classrooms, in our way of thinking. Like, what is the West? Like, is the West Paris, London, or Paris, London, Berlin, or Paris, London, Berlin, Vienna? Does Edinburgh get in there? Does Madrid get in there? Does Copenhagen or Oslo? Like, the West is just this sort of grand entity that is responsible for all this zhulch, the bile that flows into Russia. And it's been a very useful concept, right? And we do it too. Like, we talk about the West versus Russia. And there's nothing we can do about it. It's so deeply seated. But I think it does deserve some sort of critical attention and correction when it's possible, because the West, as we're talking about it, probably doesn't start really taking strong shape in Russian thought until the 1840s. It's not something that's hugely now anti-Catholicism. That's longer, but
thank you. Irina, would you like to make a concluding remark?
Not in response to any of the questions. not in response of. I mean, the general question of who is responsible is the, like...
Not who is responsible, to what degree, and how...
That's unmeasurable.
It's a matter of debate.
You know, we can criticize the failure there, but then when the failure came, we sent an army there with a game wrong place.
Yeah, as humanities scholar, I must say that everything is unmeasurable in principle. But when we talk about them or us or whoever we mean, we actually mean specific people, specific administration, specific advices to this administration, on both sides. Actually, there are not two sides; there are more sides. To all that. There's Turkey, a player, a very active player, a very unpredictable player, as we've realized in the past month. There are very many players, each is advised by a team of people whom we don't know. So when we, in these very generic terms, try to ask philosophical questions about responsibility, they're very difficult to answer in earnest. Like how do we understand responsibility? There are different people that understand their interest in a certain way and act in accordance with their understanding of their interest. Sometimes they present their interest as the interest of their country. Or it is presumed that their interest is the interest of their country, whether we buy it or not.
Okay, thank you. I need to address one point that was addressed to me, because maybe some people in the room are not familiar with this, but I have to do so briefly. So the question asked about the University of Wisconsin and referred to emails that are blaming Wisconsin for the closing of the Levada Analytics Center, which is Russia's leading independent polling organization, which last Monday was designated a foreign agent by the Russian government, which effectively shuts it down. And in that designation, work that the Levada Center has done with University of Wisconsin was cited as one of the reasons for. Now, I don't have time to address this at length right now, and I will say that on November 3rd, I'll be giving a lecture at the same time and place in which I will address the projects, the role that Wisconsin has played in much more detail. I want to point out, though, that for one thing, it's important to keep in mind that Wisconsin did not shut down Levada Center. The Putin administration is shutting down Levada Center. And that although, you know, it is a fact that Levada Center has collaborated with me and others at the University of Wisconsin in a number of studies, the circumstances of those collaborations are different from what's been characterized in the media. And that's all I'm going to say at this point. The larger issue is a tremendously difficult and painful question for those of us who try to continue to work with Russian colleagues, many of whom are still quite eager to engage with academics on mutual topics of mutual interest, and you know, who expose themselves to considerable personal risk as a result of the political context in Russia right now in doing so. And all I can say is that I don't think the answer is for us to stop trying to collaborate with Russian scholars. I think that if they're willing to take on the risk involved, and you know, if there are ways that we can work together with them to minimize those risks, it is incumbent upon us as scientists and scholars who are committed to the principle of the universality of what it is we do in our profession, and to encourage our Russian colleagues and to support them. We cannot support them by turning our backs on them or by turning away from them in their time of greatest need. So that's all I have to say in response to that. And I want to thank the audience and our panelists for a very lively and far-ranging discussion. And I want to invite you to finally, at last, enjoy the wonderful food which we have in the back. So. Sorry, I couldn't talk to you before.
The recent issue. Your question is what the mullahs would do to protect women.
Uh-huh.
And in that context,